Probably one of the first things that you did is turn on a light. Well, that is if you got up as early as I did. Maybe some of you didn't really need to do that right off. You flip a switch. You turn on the light. Not too long after that, you flip another switch and you turn on the coffee pot. Comes time to eat breakfast, you turn on the stove, and when you're done, you turn it off. And then later on, when you're in the bathroom, perhaps you are turning on the water and you're turning off the water, and you flip a switch to dry your hair. Perhaps sometime during the morning as you prepared to come to church, you turned on a TV or a radio. And then when you got in the car to come to church this morning, you turned on the switch. And when you got here, you turned it off. We're used to being able to turn on and to turn off anything that we want in life. Some of you, from the looks of you, I wish you had a switch this morning that I could turn you on. I confess, lots of times I wish I had that kind of switch in the mornings. I used to be a lot better than I am now. For some reason, I have those mornings now where I just can't seem to get going like I used to. But that is something that is so prevalent in our lifestyle that we're used to whatever we want for it to be there in an instant, and then when we're done to turn it off and forget about it. But we dare not think of worshiping God in that vein, because it will not work. You see, I'm afraid that sometimes, well, whether we consciously mean to or not, we kind of approach life with the attitude that well, now Sunday morning, I go to church and on Sunday morning I worship. Turn it off. And then when church is over, we turn it off. But my friends, that's going through a religious activity. That's not worship. There's all kinds of reasons, I suppose, that people go to church. I suppose a lot of people may go to church just because other people expect it. Parents, friends, pastor, whatever. And I suppose some people go to church because that's just their habit or that's their tradition. In this area of the country, going to church services on Sunday morning for an awful lot of people is just a part of our culture. Something they grew up with, something they do without thinking about. And there are people that go to church just to bring their kids. Now that's a whole lot better than people who send their kids. But you know, I've been aware of people that only go to church until their kids grow up and leave, and then you can't drag them in the church door. And I suppose there are people that come to church purely because, in some sense, it eases their conscience. I have done my religious duty, maybe the Lord will, you know, bless me a little bit because of it. Or I have done wrong and maybe that'll appease him in some way. And then I believe there's people that go to church just for the reason of propping up their own ego. Now that may sound a little strange, but I believe there are people that try to immerse themselves sometimes in doing religious things so, well, I'll look good to other people. People will think well of me. And I suppose and I hope that many of us are here this morning as a matter of obedience, and that's good, nothing wrong with that. But there ought to be something above that. Because even if you do it out of obedience, you're in danger of, just like all these other people, flipping it on and flipping it off for whatever reason. What I'm trying to say to you this morning is this, that worship is something that we ought to participate together in as a body of Christ, as a church, as a means of expressing together to the Lord our love and our praise, but that it should not be anything different than what is going on all week long. What is worship? Well, there is a Hebrew word that's often translated worship and a New Testament Greek word that is translated worship, and both of those words have within them the idea of bowing down before God. And it pictures for us that reverent attitude, that attitude of humility before Him and that attitude of you are everything and I owe everything to you. So worship is largely an attitude. But it is an attitude that you can't turn on and turn off. It's an attitude that's got to be there for you really to be able to worship come Sunday. The word that I'm getting at this morning that I want to focus on is the word dedication. I looked up the word dedicate in the dictionary, and it says it means to set apart for a religious purpose. Well, my friends, we ought to be set apart unto the Lord all the time. And when we worship together, it ought to be an expression of our all the time dedication to Him. I think this is something that we often forget. Now, what I want to do is look at Leviticus chapter 1, and we're going to be looking at that Old Testament sacrificial system, the first offering of those mentioned in the first 7 chapters of the book of Leviticus, the burnt offering. And as we look at this offering this morning, as we're going to look at others next week, probably for the next couple of weeks, but as we look at this Old Testament system, we're going to notice 2 things. We're going to notice what is called typology. It comes from our word type. And what that means is that when we look at these sacrifices, they're going to picture for us what Christ did on Calvary's cross. But there's a second element to those Old Testament sacrifices that picture man maintaining a right relationship with his Lord. We're going to see those 2 things over and over again as we study these particular sacrifices. And we're going to see in this burnt offering in chapter 1 of Leviticus this morning, we're going to see here the idea of man maintaining, number 2, that relationship with his Lord on the basis of his dedication to the Lord. And what this burnt offering, I believe, says to us today is simply this, that worship is an expression of dedication. Are you set apart to the Lord? Are you completely dedicated to Him? Or are you dedicated to self primarily? Or dedicated to other individuals or other pursuits above Him? If that's the case, you're going to have trouble worshiping, because worship is an expression of dedication. Now, there are 2 parts to our outline this morning that is going to help us to understand that statement, that worship is an expression of dedication. First of all, we're going to notice here that our worship is based on a recognition of what God has done for us. And there primarily is the typology, the picture of Christ in that Old Testament worship. And then secondly, and most importantly for us, we're going to notice that worship involves voluntary self-sacrifice. Now, what does that mean for us today in the New Testament? We're going to cover that in a few moments. Worship is an expression of dedication. And first of all, that means and requires, that being the case, it requires that our worship be based on a recognition of what Christ has done for us. Let's see that in the first few verses of Leviticus 1. Beginning at verse 1, it says, "And the Lord called unto Moses." The word "called" here is a translation of the Hebrew word which actually named this book. In the Hebrew Bible, it's named literally, "And He called." But in our Bibles, we call it Leviticus because it pertains to what God told them to do as far as sacrifices are concerned, and that concerned what the Levites did. So Leviticus means pertaining to the Levites. But it came from God through Moses. "And the Lord called unto Moses and spoke unto him out of the tabernacle of the congregation." Now that's out of the Old Testament temple, but before it became a temple, it was a tabernacle. It was a tent that they carried with them. And they had the ark in there, and they had the Holy of Holies and all that, and the different things and articles within it, just like the temple, but it was mobile. "And God spoke to him then," and in verse 2 it says, he's told Moses, "Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, If any man of you bring an offering unto the Lord, ye shall bring your offering of the cattle, even of the herd and of the flock. If his offering be a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish. He shall offer it of his own voluntary will at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation before the Lord. And he shall put his hand upon the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. And he shall kill the bullock before the Lord, and the priests, Aaron's sons, shall bring the blood and sprinkle the blood round about upon the altar that is by the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. The blood then is poured out on the altar, and we're going to come to this in a few moments, but the rest of the animal was to be burnt. We see in these verses the picture of Christ and what he did for us. And he was picturing it for them in those sacrifices that they may somehow comprehend that worship was all based on the fact that God, in his grace, was going to atone for the sins of mankind. So the typology, or the picture here, that is in the burnt offering, and also in the other Old Testament sacrifices as well, but we're looking at this particular one. This picture then of Christ pictures Jesus Christ at this point in time, the one who was to come, from our point in time, the one who already has, but picturing Jesus Christ as the atonement for the sins of man. Now the word atonement used there in verse 4 means primarily covering. Covering. It is that which covers us, sprinkled on the altar, between God and man. And it is our covering that turns away the wrath of God upon sinful people. You see, man's sin required the death penalty. We see this in the New Testament, Romans 6:23, for the wages of sin is death. We can see it back in the book of Genesis when he told them, if you shall eat of this tree, you what? You shall surely die. We see it right here. Because of the death penalty imposed upon man, there had to be, in order to picture what Christ would do, there had to be a death of a substitute. And so in verse 5, they're told to kill the animal. I hope this doesn't get too, as my daughter would say, gross for you this morning. Because as we look back on it, we may be tempted to kind of turn away in revulsion, but there is beautiful pictures here. And listen, what we're picturing is not a pleasant story anyway. When we're talking about man as a sinner condemned to hell, that's not a pleasant story. It's pictured here, as well as God's grace. Now, man's sin required the death penalty, and then Christ became our substitute in death. You see in verse 4 there where it says, and he shall put his hand upon the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. Before they killed that animal, the person offering the sacrifice would actually lay his hands on the head of the animal. And it doesn't just mean just reach out there to pet him. The Hebrew word means literally press down on it. They would go up there to this animal and they would just literally press down his head, picturing the fact that they are sinful. And picturing then the fact that this animal was becoming the substitute and they were putting their sin and their condemnation on that animal as an atonement. That's what happened in Jesus Christ. Now, the animal could not atone for the sins of man in reality. Only Jesus Christ could. But faith in the one coming as they performed that act indicated their confidence in the one who would be that substitute. He was a sinless substitute. Look at verse 3. In his burnt offering, if his offering be a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish. They couldn't just give away, an old ox or a sheep that had some problem, had a broken leg, or a wolf had got a bite out of it or something. It had to be perfect, picturing the sinlessness of Jesus Christ. Now, if you'll let me, we finished in verse 5. Let me read just a few more verses now, beginning in verse 6. And he shall flay the burnt offering and cut it into pieces, and the sons of Aaron the priest shall put fire upon the altar and lay the wood in order upon the fire. And the priests, Aaron's sons, shall lay the parts the head and the fat in order upon the wood that is on the fire which is upon the altar. But the inwards and the legs shall he wash in water. The priest shall burn all on the altar to be burnt, to be a burnt sacrifice, an offering made by fire of the sweet savor unto the Lord. I want you to notice that last verse talking about washing the inwards and the legs. That is the intestines and the legs. And these, of course, were parts that would have been defiled, and they had to be washed before they would be burnt. And that, again, pictures that this animal had to be perfect in a sense. There's a picture here that pictures the sinlessness of Jesus Christ. He could be the substitute for us because he had no sin. Being God, he was without sin. And only he who is without sin could pay the price of someone else's sin. I cannot pay for your sin because I have sin of my own that I am liable for, and vice versa. In verse 8, we notice the head and the fat being laid on there, and that pictures the outward, the external, the head, and the inside of the animal, and thus it pictures a complete sacrifice. He was God, and he was sinless, but he was also man, and he was a complete human substitute for man. He was God in the flesh. And so he was a perfect sacrifice. And I also want you to notice that he suffered for man. If you look at verse 6, it's speaking here of flaying, that is skinning the animal, and cutting the animal into pieces. By the way, they didn't break any bones when they did that. It was disjointed at the joints. And that too pictures Jesus Christ, who never had a bone broken, as even was the common case for those crucified. But the absolute complete separation of every organ and every part of that animal, skinned, disjointed, completely dissected, pictures the awfulness and the complete and utter destruction that a person would have to face in hell. And not only does that picture it, but the very fire of the burnt offering itself. When Aaron and his sons, the Levites, when they build that fire, and if you go over to chapter 6, in chapter 6, verses 6 to 13, there's some further instructions given just to the Levites about how to make this offering. And there we find that this fire on this particular altar, the brazen altar, the one that is out toward the front of the tabernacle, not the one back in the Holy of Holies where the priest went once a year, but this brazen altar out front where the priests offered all these sacrifices, they kept a fire burning constantly. And it pictures the fires of hell that are never quenched. And so we see within this sacrifice that which Jesus Christ did for us. And he literally suffered the pangs of hell on Calvary's cross for us, becoming sin for us, who knew no sin, that we might become the righteousness of God in him. And I want you to notice how also the complete satisfaction of God's justice is made. Look down at the very last verse we read, verse 9, the last phrase, to be a sacrifice, an offering made by fire of a sweet savor unto the Lord. In other words, it's saying that when this sacrifice was burnt, God was pleased with it. It was a sweet savor unto him. The utter and complete satisfaction of a righteous God, satisfied that his righteousness has been preserved by the sacrifice made by Christ. Now, if we are to worship Christ, if we are to worship God on Sunday morning, we have got to have before us what he has done for us all the time. Now, it's a common thing, I think, for many of us, it is for me, to come into the church and somewhere in the worship service, you think about the cross of Calvary. Especially so when we come to the Lord's Supper, I do. And that's good, but we ought to have that before us every day. Because everything we do in life, serving him and worshiping him, is based on the fact that look at what he has done for us. Picture is here, and we see that, the basis of our worship. Let's move on to point number two. If worship is an expression of dedication, and that dedication is there because we realize what He has done for us, we need to move on to the rest of what worship is. That's just the basis. Point number two is this. If our worship is an expression of dedication, then our worship has to involve voluntary self-sacrifice. Now, I want you to look with me in a few moments for some more of the details here in this burnt offering. First of all, the purpose. What was the purpose of the burnt offering? There was a purpose here. Well, first of all, it was an offering that was made at the initiative of the offerer. It wasn't commanded. They didn't say you must offer a burnt offering every day or whenever you do this or that. It was something that was left to the discretion of the individual. It was voluntary, as it says in verse 3, of his own voluntary will. Now, this burnt offering given first in the book of Leviticus is the basic Old Testament sacrifice. It even became, whether it should or not, I don't know, but it became a regular morning and evening sacrifice that the priests offered for the people later on. But originally, it was intended to be totally at the discretion of the person, the individual, to be made whenever he wanted. But it was the basic Old Testament sacrifice. Now, it was offered to atone for sin because it says in verse 4, that it would be accepted for him to make atonement for him. But yet it's not to be offered whenever that person committed an act of sin. It was an atonement for sin, but it was not to be offered only when there was an occasion of sin in your life. Now what does that say for us? Or to us? Well, there were other sacrifices we're going to come to later. The sin offering and the trespass offering. These were to be made if you did something wrong. But this burnt offering was not occasioned by an act of sin. But yet it was an atonement. And by that we can understand that it was meant to atone, or a picture, I should say, maybe, that the atonement that Christ made for original sin. Now this may be a little hard to understand, but listen to what I'm going to say here, and perhaps we can get a little handle on it. Ever since Adam sinned, every person that has ever been born has been born a sinner. It's our nature. You don't have to teach a child to do wrong. You have to teach a child to do right. They automatically do wrong. We're sinners by nature. We're sinners through and through. We have inherited that. A person can't help being a sinner. We're born sinners. And it's not only the acts of sin that we commit in our life that must be atoned for, but it's the very nature that we have that must be atoned for. And so, we recognize this. Hey, when we worship God, we don't just worship God whenever we do something wrong, do we? Oh, I know there's people that have that attitude. There are even denominations that take that approach. You worship God all the time, whether you've committed a terrible act of sin yesterday or not. You worship God because you are a sinner and you realize He has paid the price of that sin debt. Now, I want you to notice the completeness of this burnt offering. The completeness. First of all, let me just reiterate. The purpose here, to atone for original sin, or to picture the atonement for original sin, that means that it can be offered any time. Doesn't have to wait till you sin. It's a free will, a voluntary thing, any time. Now, notice the completeness of it. Everything of that animal was consumed. We saw in verse 5, that the priest would collect the blood when it was slain and it would sprinkle it on the altar. Now, that's not just a drop or two. They drained the blood. The blood was removed, put on the altar. So the blood has been taken and used. And then everything else. We saw the animal was skinned. The animal was dissected completely. Certain parts washed. It was all put on the burnt offering, on the altar, and it was all consumed in fire. Nothing was left. Nothing was spared. Now, in other Old Testament sacrifices, we'll see this in weeks to come, there was a part that the priests kept for themselves and they ate it. It was a way of providing their needs. And in other offerings, there were parts of the animal kept to be eaten not only by the priest, but also by the one who brought the offering. There's a reason for that. We'll see it later on. But in this offering, every bit was consumed. The priest got none. The offerer got nothing. It was all completely used. Nothing set aside. And so we begin to see the dedication required to bring such an offering. It was brought of our own free, of a person's own free will. But there was no ulterior motive involved, see? There was no say, well, you know, we'll go ahead and make this offering. We're supposed to do this every so often. I mean, after all, you know, we'll get a good meal out of it. That wasn't the case. When you brought a burnt offering, buddy, it all was given. We begin to see the dedication behind it. Everything consumed, nothing set aside. And notice also the effort required by the one bringing the offering. Verse 6, and he shall flay the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. That's not the priest. The priest comes in verse 7, come in verse 5 with the blood and comes in again in verse 7 where they put the rest on the altar. But the person who brought the offering had to go to great effort. I've never had to butcher a cow. But I can imagine it's a pretty good job to do that. Well, that's what's involved here. I mean, it not only was a complete sacrifice and you gave it all, but you had the person bringing that burnt offering showed his dedication, and since he had to go to great effort to make that offering. And then I want also for you to notice the value of the animal involved. If you go back now to verse 3, it says, in his offering, to go back actually to verse 2. He shall bring your offering of the cattle, even of the herd and of the flock. If his offering be a burnt offering or burnt sacrifice of the herd. Now see, what this is saying is that the burnt offering was supposed to come from the most valuable animals. The herd animals, the cattle, the ox, and so on. And the perfect ones without blemish. The most valuable thing they had in their herd. Now, when you come down to verse 11 or verse 10, we never read that. But notice verse 10, it says, and if his offering be of the flocks, namely of the sheep or of the goats for a burnt sacrifice, he shall bring in a male without blemish. And he goes on to the whole thing. And from verses 10 down through 13, he says almost the same thing about the sheep as he did about what we've already read. How do they go about offering it and so on. In other words, if you weren't a person of means and you didn't have a herd, and all you had was a flock of sheep, then you bring the best of your flock. Now you go down to verse 14. And if the burnt sacrifice for his offering to the Lord be of fowls, then he shall bring his offering of turtle doves and of young pigeons. And you see, if you were not affluent enough even to have a flock of sheep, then you could bring a fowl. But whatever your station in life, you brought the best and most valuable of what you had. And again, we see the dedication of the one making the offering. Remember the story of David who wouldn't offer unto the Lord that which cost him nothing? The value of the animal's sacrifice indicates here the dedication involved. Now let me tell you something. I don't believe for a minute that this meant that the best of their animals belonged to the Lord and the rest belonged to them. What this was saying is, Lord, it's all yours, the whole flock, the whole herd, everything I own, but I know you've given it to me that I may survive, and I just, out of appreciation and dedication to you, give you back the best. Now, if our worship is an expression of dedication, it's going to be because we realize what God's done for us. The basis. And secondly, it's going to involve a voluntary self-sacrifice on our behalf. I believe that's reasonable to conclude. Now, does that mean that when it comes Sunday morning, we put some money in the offering plate and that's like what they did in the Old Testament? Why, suppose, in a sense of the word, that's a parallel. Because in a sense, it's the same, because everything we own and possess is God's, if we understand the scripture, and we give back a portion to Him to show our dedication and love to Him, because He allows us to make use of it. But it's deeper than that. You turn to the New Testament, to Romans chapter 12. A very familiar verse. Many of you would not even have to turn here. But if you turn to Romans chapter 12 and verse 1, you're going to read these words. Paul says, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present. Now, the word present is a technical word. That means it was the word used in Paul's day for animal sacrifices, the offering. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present what? An animal? No. Your tithes, your offerings on Sunday morning? No. That ye present your bodies a living sacrifice. Holy. Set apart, dedicated. That's what the word means. Acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And the word service is a technical word. It means it was a word used to refer to the offerings made in the temple. It doesn't just mean your service, like you were nice to someone today and you served the Lord by teaching a Sunday school class. That's all involved here, but that's not the primary meaning. What it's saying is that you look at yourself, your body. Now, obviously, we are body and spirit, body and soul. So when we say body, it means everything, because our body contains within it our soul, right? Everything. You present your whole body completely and utterly and unreservedly, everything you are, everything you possess, unto God. Augustine, the great theologian of many years gone by, said that Christ is not valued at all unless he is valued above all. Life is not segments. I do this for a while, I do this for a while, and come Sunday morning I worship and then I work, and it's all disjointed. And it doesn't come Sunday morning and you flip on the worship button. Life is like that orange that you peel, and there it is in segments. But you know, you can taste a variation between different oranges. Sometimes they're good and sweet and juicy, and other times they're not so juicy and not so sweet. But you can't take two different segments out of the same orange and find a different taste, can you? They're different segments, but every segment in that particular orange has the exact same taste. That's what life is supposed to be. Yes, there are different things we do with our life. There are different facets and different parts of our life, but Jesus Christ gives it the same flavor throughout. That's what life is meant to be. And then when we come into the church building to worship, or even when we worship privately before the Lord, it is not a switch we got to turn on, which is an impossibility, but an expression of overall dedication to Jesus Christ. He died for us. We live as a living sacrifice for Him. That true worship.